Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Optimizing Outcomes for At-Risk Patient Groups Using a Multi-Biomarker Approach, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Ileana L. Pena, MD, MPH, James L. Januzzi, MD, G. Michael Felker, MD, and Christopher M. O'Connor, MD. Dr. Pena is a professor of medicine and epidemiology and population health, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, associate chief for academic affairs, division of cardiology staff, heart failure transplant, Montefiore Medical Center, Bronx, New York. Dr. Pena has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for GE Healthcare, Otsuka Pharmaceutical, and Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. She served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. Dr. Pena does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Pena does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Januzzi is an associate professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, director of cardiac intensive care unit, Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Januzzi has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Roche and Critical Diagnostics. He received grants for clinical research from Roche, Critical Diagnostics, and Siemens AG. Dr. Januzzi does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Januzzi does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Felker is an associate professor of medicine and clinical pharmacology, director of heart failure research, Duke Clinical Research Institute, Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Felker has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Roche, Critical Diagnostics, and BG Medicine. He received grants for clinical research from Roche, Critical Diagnostics, and BG Medicine. Dr. Felker does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Felker does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. O'Connor is a professor of medicine, director of Heart Center, executive director of cardiology, division of cardiovascular medicine, Duke Clinical Research Institute, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. O'Connor has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Medtronic, GE Healthcare, Amgen, Roche, Actelion Pharmaceuticals, Novella, Trevena, Martek Biosciences Corporation, Pfizer, and The Nile Company. He received grants for clinical research from Medtronic, GE Healthcare, Gilead Sciences, Roche, Critical Diagnostics, BG Medicine, and Otsuka Pharmaceutical. Dr. O'Connor does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. O'Connor does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to increase the audience's awareness of the emergence of biomarkers as a tool not only for diagnosis and risk stratification, but also for guiding therapy in a cost-effective approach. This activity is supported by Roche Diagnostics. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Ileana Pena, Professor of Medicine, Epidemiology, and Population Health at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and Montefiore Medical Center. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to our program today, which is entitled Optimizing Outcomes for At-Risk Patient Groups Using a Multi-Biomarker Approach. I am thrilled today to have as my guest Jim Januzzi, who is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard and Director of the Cardiac Intensive Care Unit at the Mass General Hospital in Boston. Welcome, Jim. Mike Felker, who's Associate Professor of Medicine and Cardiology at Duke in Durham, North Carolina. Mike, good to have you here. And Chris O'Connor, who's Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Cardiology at Duke. And it's great to have you here, Chris. And so today we're going to review why biomarkers are important, and all my guests today have tremendous amounts of experience in the biomarker field. So we're going to talk about some common scenarios, but then I'd like to go a little bit into the future and sort of think outside of the box where the biomarkers may actually be very clinically helpful. And we're going to talk about new biomarkers that you probably have not thought about, but that I think in the future are going to become available to clinicians. And so I'm going to start with a case because I think this is a good way to get the conversation going. So this is a 63-year-old man who was admitted for decompensated heart failure, not unusual for us. He has an ischemic etiology, and by echo, his ejection fraction is 23% estimated. He has been treated aggressively with diuretics and discharged home after 4.5 days, which is about the Medicare mean of length of stay. When he came in to the hospital, his proBNP was 3,500, and at discharge, it was 2,800. And so the questions I've asked here, should we have a target for proBNP at discharge? Should we have a target for follow-up? And what is the implication of this discharge value? What other biomarkers could guide us? And Chris, I'm going to start with you, and what does your group do at Duke with this type of patient?
Well, thank you, Ileana. I mean, this is really a very important question, particularly in my hat as director of the Duke Heart Center. As you know, readmission rates in 30 days and hospitalization mortality at 30 days or 30-day mortality is something that we're measured by now as hospitals. And so we're looking for strategies in our heart failure patients to see if we can reduce the risk of readmission or death at 30 days. And so this case, I think, highlights something very interesting. You have a patient who comes in with systolic dysfunction, congested, and there's really not much movement of the biomarker.
How would you categorize the 3,500? High, medium, high?
You know, that's kind of in the medium range. It's not super high. We often see levels that are higher. Our registry and trial data say that that there would be a higher one, but there hasn't been much movement here. And the strategy we use, which is certainly a strategy, not the strategy that's used across the country, is to really sample the marker two or three times during the hospitalization and really look at the pre-discharge one and look for somewhere around 50% reduction.
Okay.
If it's not reduced in the 33 to 50% range or greater, then we may hold the patient and optimize medicines better, because we're very worried about that readmission rate.
Do your care managers get on your back about
keeping
the patients
they
in
do,
longer?
They do, but I think they also get on their back when that patient comes back with a readmission.
That's right. And now payments be suffering,
yeah,
so
right.
it's a call to action
on
here.
So this case worries me because that the proBNP level has not dropped as much as I would like to see with the therapy that was instituted here.
So 50% would have been at like 1,700.
That's what I would have liked to have seen in this patient.
What about discharge? What would you do once you see them in the clinic? Do you expect another further lowering?
Well, we do, and we still try to optimize medications based on what that value looks like.
So, Jim, I'm going to turn to you. I mean, you have done this incredible PROTECT trial, and you've presented this and published it. But I know you're looking at more data into PROTECT. So I wonder if, for our audience, could you just give us a brief overview of PROTECT?
Sure.
And what else have you done to take a look at not only outcomes, but what does the ventricle look like?
Yeah, see, I mean, the issue here is that we know that natriuretic peptides are prognostic, and we know that they're useful to identify patients with impending instability and potential hospitalization or worse. Through optimizing medical care to try to achieve as low an NT-proBNP value as we could, aiming for a target value of about 1,000, I think in the outpatient arena, it's a little more established now that the lower the value, the better. Mm-hmm. But if you can achieve a value of around 1,000 or lower, the event rates go exceptionally low.
So is that how you did your trial, trying to lower to 1,000?
Exactly. So we took patients with recent instability, with systolic dysfunction, and adjusted their medications against their NT-proBNP values to try to achieve that cut point. This was compared to a strategy of aggressive heart failure care without the NT-proBNP guidance. And what we found was that this approach of aiming for the NT-proBNP as low as we can get it, below 1,000 if possible, we reduced heart failure hospitalizations by more than 50%. So this approach of biomarker-guided care seems to really improve outcomes. But there seems to be more to it than just that. And that's the next step that we're taking, which is we're looking at, besides the effects on outcome and besides the effects on quality of life, which are substantial in a favorable way, we've looked at the effects of aggressive heart failure care on cardiac structure and function. And, you know, remodeling is such an important, pertinent outcome mm-hmm. measure for long-term.
And it's been one of the consistent findings, for example, in the beta blocker trials,
right,
that reverse remodeling is a very powerful predictor of better outcomes.
Correct. And, you know, simply guiding care utilizing natriuretic peptides, whether it was as a direct consequence of the reduction in natriuretic peptide or simply more assiduous application of these agents, we see more reverse remodeling associated with NT-proBNP guided care.
How would you have done this patient? Now, he was aggressively diuresed. Would you have added something else to his care now based on your study and your experience with up-titrating drugs?
Well, you know, as Chris said, and I'm curious to hear what Mike has to say, you know, we know that the discharge value trumps everything, you know, mm-hmm. in terms mm-hmm. of the likelihood for outcomes, right, Mike? So you saw that in a large data set.
In Optimize.
In Optimize, right. So, you know, lower is always better, even coming out of the hospital. You know, as Chris said, delaying discharge is one option. Enrolling them into a telemonitoring program, which is not a one-size-fits-all, the higher-risk patients clearly do mm-hmm, better with mm-hmm. that approach, might be another way. But whatever the case may be, the first visit that this patient comes into the office, I would resample their NT-proBNP okay. and continue trying to push down to that goal of 1,000 if possible.
By up-titrating other drugs.
Correct. You look for the seams. You look for the opportunities. And,
right.
you know, in general, those opportunities exist. And it's up to us to recognize where they may be. The biomarker doesn't tell you what to do. It just tells you something needs to be done.
And I think it's a great point for clinicians. We always think we're doing the right thing. We always think we have the max doses. But if you stop a minute and you look, you may have room for a little tidying up, a little up titration, whether I think in your study spironolactone went up
right.
as well.
Yeah, we pushed a lot of drugs up.
Pushing
upwards.
The ACE inhibitor a little bit more, adding the beta blocker or pushing the beta blocker. So I think the lesson here is that don't be content with what you've been doing. Take another look. Now, Mike, I know you've been working on other biomarkers that are becoming kind of interesting. So do you want to share with us what you've been doing?
Sure. I mean, and I think this is a nice segue. And Jim's data very nicely suggests that it might not just be how low you get, but how you get there that matters. So in a patient like this, I mean, you could diurese them more and more and probably get their natriuretic peptide levels down some more. But it may not be the same as getting it down by increasing the intensity of their neurohormonal antagonism, which is really what the remodeling data suggests. Diuretics don't make you remodel your ventricle. It's drugs like beta blockers and ACE inhibitors and aldosterone antagonists. I think what's interesting where we are now in the biomarker world, we've had the natriuretic peptides. We're all pretty accustomed now with using them, but we now have all these other markers either available now or coming available, which will help us measure other processes like remodeling. So some examples would be ST2, GDF15, galectin-3, all markers we think that are related potentially to the remodeling process, and you might think of as providing what I call orthogonal information to the natriuretic peptide. So the natriuretic peptides are mostly driven by stretch, and some of these other markers can kind of integrate other pathophysiologic
processes. Is galectin a ventricular, ventricular secretory?
Yeah, I think all these markers, I mean, they like so much in biology, they have this kind of pluripotent stimuli. So many of them are stimulated by the same set of processes, by ischemia, by neurohormonal activation, by myocardial stretch. But in particular, the galectin-3 and the ST2, we think, seem to be markers of what's actually going on in the ventricle. And as you said, ventricular remodeling is one of these things that we've learned over the years seems to be a fairly reliable surrogate for good long-term outcomes. If the ventricle is getting smaller and less
and
spherical,
staying there.
That's almost always a good thing. And so the problem is that what we see on an echocardiogram is a fairly late, the horse is out of the barn, as we say in North Carolina. So the question is, can we identify these remodeling events when we have a chance to still intervene? So I think, you know, and this is not 2011, but some future date, the ability to figure out between a patient like this, you know, is just what they need more diuretics or do they need more aggressive anti-remodeling strategy? And right now we treat all our heart failure patients the same, but I think in the future our hope is that we can better divide patients into particular buckets based on what treatment that their particular physiology would benefit the most from. And I think that's where some of these new biomarkers can really be helpful.
It's really difficult, I think, for clinicians to take a look at a group of patients and say, here's the one that is riskiest for readmission. And Chris, you sort of pointed out at that, letting them out before their BNP gets down because you're concerned about readmission. How have you used galectin? Have you looked at galectin in any one of the large data sets that we have? I think HF Action has provided some sampling for that.
Yeah, Mike has been leading that effort to look at it in the HF Action biomarker bank, and it's an interesting biomarker, I think, in HF Action. It kind of reflects maybe that was a well-treated group. Mm-hmm. It looks reasonably well by itself, but when you start adding other markers in there, the performance is not as strong as N-terminal proBNP. So I think that when we get into this multi-marker we're going to have to test it, and we have a high bar to go over.
Yeah,
it's a pretty high bar.
I mean, I think a key point is moving from the concept of risk stratification, which is obviously important, but beyond that to identifying what I'll call intervenable risk.
Right.
That is not just, it's of limited value to say, well, this patient is high risk and
you
can't
do
anything about
it.
But it's not just saying this patient is high risk, but the next step is this patient is high risk, and we think based on the pathophysiology we're seeing reflected in the biomarkers, and not just one, but probably multiple, that the way to mitigate the risk in this particular patient is this approach or that approach. As right now, we definitely have a sort of one-size-fits-all approach to heart failure management, which I think has served us reasonably well. We've come a long way in the last 20 years with neurohormonal antagonism. We still have a long way to go in individualizing
treatment. If we only looked at the guidelines, we might be doing better.
Perhaps.
But,
very true. Yeah.
But the gap is still there. So should we be doing a large trial?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a bias because
we all have a bias
yeah,
here.
Yeah, so we're planning, and hopefully we'll get funded this large outcomes trial from the National Institutes of Health called GUIDED, looking at really testing the efficacy of a biomarker-guided approach to chronic heart failure therapy in the same way we would test the efficacy of a new drug. That is a large trial.
Protocol-driven.
Protocol-driven, right. Hard outcomes, sufficient statistical power. So, I mean, really springboards off a lot of the work people like Jim have done in the PROTECT trial. So I think that's, you know, it's an exciting opportunity. What we're really talking about is this whole concept of personalized medicine, which is a buzzword these days. But this is actually kind of putting it in the clinic where people are actually taking care of patients and figuring out, can we use the markers we know about and potentially novel markers down the road to actually personalize and streamline treatment. I mean, as we know, our heart failure patients, they all take a huge number of medications, and it's quite a burden. It affects compliance. A lot of them are elderly. They have other comorbid conditions.
And the cost of the drugs, which is amazing.
I think, you know, when you consider the guided therapy trials in totality, you can recognize that while many of them were very interesting and compelling, if you put them all together and total up the entire number of patients mm-hmm. randomized, it numbers only in the several thousand range.
So it's still very small.
Over a decade past, this concept, which is a very viable mm-hmm. one, really hasn't been examined in the way that we'd like to look at it. And I think that a large-scale pivotal trial will allow us not only to examine the interactions with specific therapies, mm-hmm. as Michael's saying, as well as with novel markers, highly sensitive troponin, another very important remodeling marker in heart failure.
And easy to get because
widespread
they get
availability.
It most of the time anyway yeah. when the patient comes
Correct.
In.
Correct, exactly. And ST2, galectin, others. Looking at the interplay with extra cardiac comorbidities, markers of renal function,
age.
I mean, think of that as a biomarker, right?
It's not worked out in some of the trials.
So how we approach, exactly. So some trials show that elderly patients don't respond as well. So the question is, how do we approach the individual patient,
the
personalized approach? Because that's really the way that I think the issues that we're dealing with in modern heart failure can really be addressed.
So at least at the beginning, we could advise the clinician to get that pre-discharge BNP and compare it and say, I need to do more. Yeah. And maybe to begin, that's a patient you need to see a little bit more frequently, you need to see sooner.
Clinicians need to think about this scenario. How often have you had someone that comes into the hospital with acutely decompensated failure, 24 hours later, with maybe half a kilo of diuresis, mm-hmm. they say, I feel ready to go home.
I'm ready to get out of
and
here.
And they agitate to leave, and against your better judgment, you let them go. 2 days later, they're back in.
And they're
ED.
Back in again, right.
I mean, it really points to this distinction between what I call clinical congestion mm-hmm. and subclinical or kind of biochemical congestion. So in a patient like the case you showed, I mean, if you said, are they may feel better, they're not short of breath anymore.
Yeah, he was
diuresed. But they're certainly not completely decongested.
Right,
and I think one of the things that we've done, we've had this very important, powerful push in the United States to decrease length of stay, a lot of financial pressures. And sometimes I think
over?
It's kind of a penny, it's kind of a little bit short-sighted because we're in a rush to get these people out maybe before they're totally decongested. And it may be, and this is something you could actually test, that a little more effort up front during the index hospitalization can cut down on these rehospitalizations, which are both very expensive.
That's right.
And we know very morbid. I mean, getting hospitalized again and again over a short period of time is definitely not fun.
Not good.
That seems to be the trend, at least, with especially 30-day, the focus on 30-day. We're actually being more careful up front because of that fact.
Which is, frankly, that, I mean, in Europe, that's been kind of the approach
And we have data now that correlate the longer length of stay with the shorter readmission rate. So there may, in fact, be something there. I think the length of stay shortening has had its day and gone.
Yeah.
And I find that now most case managers are actually thinking about not pushing us to get the patients out the door.
Yeah.
So I want to go into the future a little bit. A lot of conversation about valvular disease, aortic stenosis, mitral regurgitation, certainly quite common in heart failure as the patients are advancing. We had mitral valve data, I know coming from Michigan, of initial success. Later on, the success hasn't been that remarkable, and we still worry about these patients progressively getting worse. So if I had to put you into the future, let me give you an example, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about both aortic stenosis. When do you do the surgery? When do you put a clip in? Now we're starting to see the clips. So let me give you an example. Here's a 55-year-old woman who has a history of mild LV dysfunction and normal coronaries, and her PCP has been listening to a systolic murmur for years, but 5 years before you've seen her, he recommends an echo. Ejection fraction is 45%, has 2 to 3 plus MR with some prolapse, and this is a non-ischemic. So she gets referred to a cardiologist who's trying to decide when to send the patient to surgery. She's now class 2. So this is not the people that would ordinarily come to the heart failure clinic. So we've considered giving this patient enrolling in a trial. How are you going to make these decisions in the future? Can the biomarkers help the clinician bring that patient to an operation if needed at the right time before it's too late and the ventricle now will not recover?
No, I think it can. I mean, I think that this is a great case, structural heart disease, valvular heart disease, where biomarkers and can really help sort of guide the clinician. As you know, there's not many randomized trials to help us here. So understanding when the patient is decompensated but not too far so that they may be harmed, you know, they may have a tough time with the surgery is really the critical thing, I think. And this is where great space for biomarkers to come into, because you want to get them when they're beginning to decompensate, but haven't tipped over the edge where the operative risk would go way up. So I think natriuretic peptide biomarkers, other biomarkers can play a great role in structural heart disease.
You know, and seeing an ejection fraction of 45% may give you some comfort to say, oh, it's 45% and it's actually already abnormal.
Yeah. Right, you could just make the compelling argument to do the valve, but the real question is mechanistically, is the EF from the valve? I mean, these are the things we struggle with a lot.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, this is where some of these, the big questions in patients like this are, really relate to their ventricle. How healthy is it really?
That's right.
How is it gonna? How much reversibility is there versus damage that's already been done? And I think this is where increasingly some of these novel markers we've mentioned, like GDF15, galectin-3, ST2, could all potentially play a role in helping us understand, you know, how sick is this ventricle? Is it going to recover, or is it actually going to be harmed by replacing? You know, is that mitral regurgitation actually helping? Helping it, and ejection fraction, especially in people with mitral regurgitation, is a pretty crude measure because
it's so misleading.
I mean, we can make it even more provocative and say an EF of 60, but with a rising ST2 or a rising GDF or a rising NT-pro, right? You know, there. So I have a large number of patients with mitral valve prolapse in my clinic. We have an outstanding set of mitral surgeons at the Mass General.
Very common.
You know, the question is, do you intervene on a totally asymptomatic normal EF patient with a prolapsed valve that's a chip shot to fix, right?
Right.
So one of the things that I tend to do, although I'm maybe a little bit more on the edge on this one, is I routinely monitor natriuretic peptides in these patients. And there are a good number of patients that show so-called heart failure range NT-proBNP values in the absence of symptoms.
They look good.
So you talk about clinical congestion as opposed to biochemical congestion, and I can tell you that I personally would be greatly alarmed if I ever saw that my NT-proBNP was, you know, 2,000, you know? And in that context, one could start making a philosophical and scientific argument that prognosis is already down in these patients and they probably should be considered for repair.
Maybe putting them on the treadmill and getting their cardiopulmonary tests. I think they may be asymptomatic because nobody has pushed them.
And we don't do that, right? I mean, you don't put somebody through a CPET, you know, with asymptomatic.
Well,
with a line or, you know, I mean, it's a pretty
Action
unusual
investigators.
Thing.
Yes, yes. But I mean, I've had a patient who played tennis pretty competitively, a woman, and she had mitral regurg that her, this is very similar to this case, had followed for a long time, heard the murmur, didn't do anything. And they sent her to me, and of course I uptitrated her medicines, and then she came in one day, she says, I can't play two sets anymore.
Well, I mean, that there.
I can only do one set.
I'm not sure I put her in a CPET. I'd probably just say,
No, I sent her. I sent her in for surgery. And she had a tough time after surgery.
Interesting.
Like many of these patients do. Mike, you were going to make some comment.
I was just going to say, and I agree completely, this is kind of a classic gray zone of clinical decision making.
Right.
We don't, some things, you have a patient with bad systolic dysfunction, you know he needs to be treated with a beta blocker. Like, it's clear what to do. There's a lot of clinical scenarios, and this is a great one, where we don't have big trials to guide us, and we're kind of on the fence because we're trying to understand the balance of potential benefit versus potential risk.
Right.
And this is a place where I think biomarkers can really serve a useful, I call it like a tiebreaker function.
Right.
Like, you're based on your clinical assessment, you're pretty, I mean, in the patient you described, somebody whose NT-proBNP is 50, you're going to view very differently as somebody whose NT-proBNP is 300.
This is new territory. This is very new territory.
You know, we have patients with aortic stenosis. You send them to the OR. They get their AVR. You wait it until they develop symptoms, and the surgeon comes out and says, "Oh boy, that ventricle is like a football,
right?
And, you know, the patient's struggling." You know, so I really do foresee that we're going to be deciding on intervention in a very different way in the future.
I really like the AS example, because 80-year-olds and trying to get symptoms of heart failure. You know, and that's really hard to sort of tease out.
That tackles both things, the age issue and the valvular issue.
And with TAVI now, you know, as a possible choice,
it's
going to change everything in terms of how we do things.
And the comorbidities in these older patients really makes you very concerned about sending them to surgery. Mm-hmm. So I want to wrap up, and I want to thank each and every one of you for being here today. I think this was a great discussion. And for our viewers, I want to leave you with the thought that perhaps getting BNP at discharge is something that you may want to add to your clinical scenario. And those patients who really do not decrease, and maybe using Dr. O'Connor's example of that 50% reduction, may actually prompt you to see that patient a little bit sooner, push on those drugs a little bit, and we hope that the NIH funds guide it so that we can continue doing the right work to find the right reason for testing these patients and treating them appropriately. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I look forward to our next time together. Good day.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Optimizing Outcomes for At-Risk Patient Groups Using a Multi-Biomarker Approach. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.